started.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mike, and thank you to Mike and Shelley and Rob for getting this whole thing together. It's I think it's a really fantastic opportunity to meet and discuss in this diverse community. And so I'm really looking forward to talking about protein complexes to you today and their evolution and assembly. And obviously, I don't need to say this, but obviously just shout at any point if you have any comments or questions. So as you can see from this figure, the way I'm thinking about evolution in this talk today is in the context of the three-dimensional structure of proteins. And I mean, why is it important to think about evolution in three dimensions instead of two dimensions, the sequences, which is sort of much more common? Well, what I'll throw out there to you is that life actually takes place in three and even four dimensions in space and time. And so if we want to understand the constraints on proteins, it's really a very fruitful approach to understand their three-dimensional structures and their interactions and interfaces with other proteins, small molecules, nucleic acids, and so on. And one thing that I would really love one day is to put together sort of more formal methods of molecular evolution with the protein complexes. And that's sort of, I guess, a journey that we're slowly kind of, we and others are kind of inching our way towards. The thing that you always have to contend with when you're dealing with three-dimensional structures is that the data, the amount of data is much more sparse than sequences. And so there are very few protein families, there are very few homologs with many different structures, kind of densely sampled. And so we sort of deal with these constraints in the data, generate new data ourselves, and try to kind of go forwards and learn more about how proteins evolve in terms of their interactions. And so why is this important? Well, I think Emmanuel already showed this simulation from Adrian Elcock yesterday. I can't remember exactly, but I think it's a beautiful illustration of what an E. coli cell might look like in three dimensions in terms of the dense packing, this very, very crowded cellular environment in prokaryotes and eukaryotes. And the point I really want you to take home here is that the proteins are interacting in very specific ways with each other, so the different chains are in different colors, and you can see there are small and large complexes. There are many complexes that are repetitive and symmetrical, so this is going to be an important point. So here you can see the light pink and dark pink kind of heterotetrameric complex has a twofold symmetry that's repeated. There's a ring somewhere with a fivefold symmetry, and then there's sort of higher order repeats. And as you can imagine, the challenge sort of in evolving this environment is basically for the polypeptide chains to be synthesized, fold, and assemble in a specific way very, very quickly, avoid aggregation and misfolding, and also avoid binding to nonspecific partners for too long as they sort of make their way through the cell. And one of the tools that we developed to tackle the question about how protein complexes evolve was work by Emmanuel, who's here and who did this when he was a PhD student in my group in sort of 2004, 5, and 6. And this was really a tour de force by Emmanuel. I don't just mean the artistic representation that he's done very beautifully here, but also the classification of protein-protein interactions in terms of known three-dimensional structure, in terms of these miniature graphs. And this has really turned out to be an extremely powerful tool because we can then use graph theory and graph matching and all the network algorithms to analyze protein complexes, to analyze three-dimensional structures. And using the full atom representation, the full coordinate representation, space-filling type representation over here, means that you're dealing with orders of magnitude more data, and you're much slower in terms of dealing with the structures. So just in case this isn't entirely clear, what we're showing here are homomeric protein complexes. So there are cases where polypeptide chains of the same type are binding to each other, so there's symmetry. And it's starting down here, what you've got are two tetramers, the green and the yellow. So there are four polypeptide chains that are interacting with themselves, so the simplest kind of protein complex, really. And in this case, you can see that there's a cyclic symmetry, like in this orange hexameric ring here, where there are six subunits in the same plane. In this tetramer, you can see that there's dihedral symmetry in the sense that there are two dimers that are stacking on top of each other. So it's like hemoglobin. There's two dimers forming a tetramer. In the hexamer here, you can see there's two trimers stacking on top of each other, or three dimers, depending on how you view it, and so on. And so the just to make it entirely clear, the nodes are the polypeptide chains, and the edges are the interfaces, the buried surface area that's sticking the two polypeptide chains to each other, the protein interaction, essentially. And so, as I've just shown you, homomers are the simplest type of protein complexes. So here's a homodimer. Heteromers is perhaps something that you may think of more commonly, which is interactions between different gene products, different polypeptide chains. So hemoglobin is alpha 2, beta 2, generally, apart from fetal hemoglobin, which is gamma 4. But this is actually two different types of polypeptide chains. And here there's four different types of polypeptide chains that are assembling into a larger complex. It turns out that homomers in these big sort of hairball type graph representations, we're always dealing with heteromers, but in the cell, protein complexes love to interact with themselves, polypeptide chains love to interact with themselves, and homomeric complexes are actually very, very common. So we're going to start, but in any case, the three questions that I want to ask here, and the two first ones are published on published work, and the third one is on unpublished work, so I hope I can get through these two more quickly and then spend a bit more time on this. The first question is whether the assembly of protein complexes, so I haven't shown this so far, but basically, obviously to get to this state of being an intact protein complex, the polypeptide chains have to fold and then bind to each other. And so there has to be some sort of process by which the complex is formed in the cell or in solution. And our question is basically whether this assembly process is something that's sort of stereotypical rather than random, and whether it's something that imposes a constraint on protein evolution. And then secondly, if this is the case, and I hope I'll convince you that it is, what we want to ask is, what are the precise mutational mechanisms that take a complex from one state to another state, so a dimer to a tetramer, for instance, and back? And an obvious mutational mechanism is that there are changes in the interface itself, so the residues that are sticking to each other. But actually, what I'll show you is that it's just as common that there are actually distant mutations that affect quaternary structure. And then finally, what I'll discuss is unpublished work where we're trying to use principles of assembly to predict the space of all topologies of quaternary structures in the protein universe, and to basically organize this space in a more abstract way than we did in the 3D complex database. So I'll come on to that. Okay, so the first question is whether assembly pathways actually impose an evolutionary constraint. And so just to explain that a bit more clearly, if you imagine a monomeric polypeptide chain, it's just been synthesized by the ribosome, in the cell, or actually in an analogous way in evolution, it then needs to evolve an interface to another subunit of itself. And this interface has an internal twofold symmetry. So you're kind of getting a twofold bang for your buck with each mutation, because each mutation will occur twice within that symmetric interface. And you can then get dimerization basically happening in assembly or evolution. Then, as I mentioned for the hemoglobin example, this dimeric module can itself again dimerize, that's why this arrow is in the same red color, and form a tetramer. And again, this space filling, this kind of cool, funky representation is thanks to Emmanuel, who did this work. And what can also happen to the monomer is that it evolves an asymmetric interface where the head its head interacts with the tail of itself to form these donut-shaped planar symmetries that have a single axis of rotation down the middle and form a trimer, tetramer, pentamer. So you can get these, depending on the angle between the head-to-tail interface, you can get these larger and larger rings forming. And you can see from an evolutionary point of view, from a mutational point of view, this is a different kind of interface because the residues that are interacting with themselves aren't repeated within that interface. If it's not clear, just say so. So this dimeric unit, I said, if it forms a second dimeric interface, it'll form this dihedral tetramer. And you can see here, this tetramer has a different geometry from this tetramer, and I showed you that already on the 3D complex slide originally. So, now, what can also happen is that the dimer can trimerize, forming this hexamer. Four times this will form an octamer, and so on. So these are these other cyclization events that are analogous to these, except the module here is the dimer. So you've got a kind of multiplication event that's happening at a higher level. And
is there a sense of how much more likely or easier it is to achieve these closed circles than just keep growing as a helix?
I mean, in terms of the mutational pathways, I don't think there's any difference. In terms of selection, obviously, it'll be completely different.
Well, if it's like, you know, if it's head to tail, kind
yeah.
of a new interface that gives you head to tail origin of two monomers.
Yeah. It's
like
the same as.
Everything you would do would not be to have a perfectly closed
yeah.
planar. She could actually just grow as a.
It's the same,
so,
yeah.
So my question is
kind of, except that, yeah. I mean, so you're right that in terms of, for a patch of the same size, the number of mutations would be the same. But basically, you'll have.
The outcome that you get, which is the more likely outcome? Would it be more stable?
Well, it depends on whether you're meaning that, like the sort of random evolution, or whether you're meaning selection. So that's what I'm trying to explain. So what I'm saying is that to form a patch of the same size, the number of mutations would be the same, but the selection would be completely different because the biphysical stability of an open symmetry with a helix that only has that interface and no other contacts. Because it'll want to form contacts kind of down as well, right? Like in a protein for stability. Otherwise, you'll get this massively floppy thing. That then imposes completely different constraints on selection and also function, obviously, and so on. So we're only dealing with closed symmetries. I mean, what Emmanuel talked about yesterday are open symmetries, and they, you know, with work from Emmanuel and from many other people on individual. Like the CTP synthase enzyme that's been reported and so on, we're learning that this may be more common inside the cell than we've appreciated so far. But in terms of the vast amount of data, in terms of, you know, what we have to work with from the PDB on three-dimensional structures, it's closed symmetries. So that's what our work, that's what I'm going to talk about today.
Is that an observer bias?
Quite possibly, yeah.
That's what Wallace is getting at, to have these cyclical structures, and you have to have exactly the right angle otherwise.
Yeah.
So a lot of guys that are monomies are going to make these.
Yeah.
Right?
Correct.
That's,
yeah.
That's
yeah. But then the question is, what's the selection on that kind of structure? Like, I mean, you know, what Emmanuel showed was these fibers are, you know, they can pierce the cell, and these, obviously, he gets the cells to grow happily, but.
Those fibers are not helical.
No. No.
Hypothetically, you can conceive of that, but is there any evidence that these structures exist in nature for helical multi-protein assemblies?
I mean, I think the CTP, or was it that one or a different enzyme that is helical? So, yeah.
So,
yeah.
The recording doesn't pick up very well people asking you questions. Maybe you repeat their questions.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah. So one final point I want to make on this slide before I move on is just that if you think about the these dihedral symmetries on top, it's worth noting that let's pick the hexamer. It can be arrived at, as I kind of tried to point out, through a stack of two trimers, so a dimer of trimers, or through a trimer of dimers, and this will become relevant in a minute. Let me think, what's the next slide? Okay, So just to spend another minute here. So basically, the point of this work, which is old work now, was that we can actually predict which of these two pathways occurs in both evolution and assembly. And it turns out that we have evidence from in vitro experiments, biophysical experiments, where we disassemble and reassemble these complexes, that these are the major pathways that are taken. So for a hexamer, it'll assemble via either a dimer or a trimer. So these will be the major intermediates. There won't be four subunits or five subunits or within the assembly pathways. There'll be either dimers or trimers, and then you get the hexamer. And the choice of whether the dimer or the trimer is the intermediate is dictated by the buried surface area within the trimer, within the dimer, relative to the other interface. And what happens both in evolution and in assembly is that the intermediate is the one with the larger buried surface area, so the more stable intermediate. So it's kind of equilibrium by looking at homologies within the whole data set of protein complexes, and by doing biophysical experiments on a dozen or so protein complexes, the picture that emerges is that the most stable intermediate, kind of in an equilibrium sense, is also the intermediate that's the species that's present in the assembly pathway, and that's the pathway that's taken in evolution. And so the question is this unifying principle of evolution assembly that goes through the most stable intermediate with the largest buried surface area, the largest interfaces between the subunits, is something like that also true for heteromeric complexes that are more complex in terms of their symmetries and so on? And so that's what we set out to do. A very talented Canadian postdoc in the group set out to do many years later, Joe Marsh. And the question that we're asking here again is the order of assembly important? So clearly, if you just take a completely random model where you've got, let's say, a heteromer with four different types of species, each repeated twice, and you try to put together those pieces of the puzzle in a random order, you know, your IKEA customer who's assembling their piece of furniture, their protein complex, is still going to be there in the middle of the night trying to find these pieces, trying to find the right way, the right order to assemble them in a random way. But if he reads the instruction manual, then these pieces kind of assemble, click, 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 and ta-da, basically you've got your nice intact protein complex, you've got your piece of furniture. And so the question that we're asking here is, what's the instruction manual for protein complexes, for polypeptide chains? What are the instructions that they're reading in order to bind to the next subunit and form the intermediate species on the road to making the intact complex? And so the question that we're asking is analogous to the protein folding problem about whether, you know, the Leventhal paradox, where basically Cyrus Leventhal asked, like, how long would it take for a polypeptide chain to fold to its native conformation? And if it were, the amino acid contacts were formed randomly, then it would take sort of longer than the age of the universe or something like that. Whereas what happens, obviously, is that proteins fold spontaneously, as was shown by Anfinson, and they follow this protein folding landscape to get to their native structure at the bottom of the funnel. And so they fold extremely rapidly, and they've evolved to do that. And so the question for protein complexes is analogous. Are these polypeptide chains basically finding their subcomplexes? And can we predict it? So for protein folding, that's a problem that hasn't been cracked yet. But for protein complexes, it's kind of a more limited problem. Can we predict these pathways? And are they conserved in evolution? And if they're conserved in evolution, then that's telling us that they're functionally important. So that's a really... Understanding evolution in this context has a really important kind of implications for function and for prediction of structure. So it has a direct application. It's not just a sort of intellectual exercise. And what we show is that the disassembly pathways can be predicted from the crystal structures in terms of their interfaces. So we take several examples that we study by nanoelectrospray mass spectrometry with Carol Robinson's group, with whom we have a fantastic collaboration, ones that have been studied in the literature, and we see whether we can correctly predict the assembly steps. And based on this principle of interface size, the vast majority of steps is correctly predicted. So this is much, much better than random.
Can you elaborate on how is assembly measured?
By the species. So basically, we take the purified complex that usually the crystallographers give us, then we titrate with increasing salt concentrations, and then use this native mass spectrometry, where you're measuring the mass of you're maintaining the non-covalent interactions, you're measuring the mass of the intact complex to identify the species, the intermediate species during the titration time course. And then we can also go backwards and reassemble with back to lower salt concentration. I mean, it's obviously completely, there's several caveats, and you know, it will be foolish of me to say that's what's happening inside the cell, because you've got, you know, the polysome sitting on the RNA, and so
yeah.
Yeah, I mean the titration is equilibrium,
yeah.
Whereas you know there may be kinetic effects basically if you're just taking unfolded, unassembled polypeptide chains and somehow putting them together. But so that's a good point. I mean, what I will say is that from the homomers, where we did this same type of experiment, we saw that the homologs follow these pathways. So the evolutionary relationships follow these pathways in assembly. So that's some evidence that there's that these intermediates are important somehow. And then here for the heteromers, the evidence is that the gene fusion and fission events are strongly biased to conserve these pathways as well.
Yeah. Maybe related to Ben's question, of those 23 of 27 that they were predicted properly,
yeah.
I assume that those are mostly for dissociation and increasing salt concentration. Is it also for reassociation?
Yeah.
For all?
Yeah. I mean, so I don't know.
I get it, this issue that I mean, arguably the increasing salt concentration dissociation.
Yeah, so you reassociate by dialysis. So you can go backwards by dialysis. For many complexes, you can go backwards and forwards. It doesn't always work. But. I mean, this isn't like a single molecule, kinetic chemistry experiment. It's an equilibrium experiment, regardless of which direction you go. But I mean, the fact that those are the major species that you observe are the more stable ones. And those are also the relationships that are conserved in evolution. You know, that suggests that there's, to me, that there's some functional meaning to these pathways. And in heteromers, what Joe did was to take all the fusion fission events observed from genomes with resources like the string database, and then superimpose them on the three-dimensional structures of protein complexes. And so what you've got here is a urease, which is a nine subunits heterotrimer that's multiplied three times, alpha, beta, and gamma subunits. And then in a different bacterium, the gamma and beta are fused, which you can see here. And then in jack bean, in a plant, all three subunits are fused. And so basically, these fusion events actually inform us about constraints on assembly. It turns out, yeah. Sorry, it's okay. It's not. I don't have the other figure. So just to make it clear, basically, if you fuse, for instance, gamma with alpha, then the you'd have covalent links between different polypeptide chains, and so what would happen is that the minute you've got two polypeptide chains fused to each other, they will automatically form an intermediate in assembly because they're covalently linked, and so they are essentially together and will interact first. And these fusion events are basically biased towards maintaining the intermediates that we predict through their buried through this principle of buried surface area. And so for the heteromers, we weren't able to use the evolutionary relationships between complexes because there are not many cases where you have homologous complexes from many different species. For the homomers, there's much more because there's much more data in the protein data bank. And so that's why we resorted to this fusion fission data to make this inference. Yeah, sorry.
So just to make sure I understood, if you look at the sizes of the interfaces between the different components and you rank them, then the larger interfaces get satisfied first.
Yeah.
And then,
precisely.
And then the question is, I don't know if you've tried this or just if you can speculate, if you shuffled the genes so they were being formed in like the wrong order,
So she's asking whether if you shuffle the genes, right, and then what happens? And this is a very excellent question, actually, a very smart question, because where that's relevant is in prokaryotes where you've got operons. And there, what it turns out, that the subunits of complexes are very often part of the same operon. And so they're actually synthesized from the same mRNA molecule. And so as they're synthesized by the ribosome, they're going to be in close proximity to each other in a one-to-one stoichiometry, which is the stoichiometry that's most often found in nature. So you very, very rarely get non-bijective, non-one-to-one stoichiometries. And then the question is this operon organization there for co-regulation, transcriptional co-regulation, or does it have some implication for the assembly pathway in terms of kinetics? So the first one is first, and then the second one third, and so on. And for a long time, we didn't really have enough data to address this in a statistically significant way. But now my former postdoc, Joe, who's now group leader in Edinburgh, he's done this work. And basically, he's taken all the operons for which we have complexes with three or more subunits. And it turns out that in operons, there is a bias for the polypeptide chains that are the more stable intermediates for them to be like the first and the second in the operon, you know, 5' to 3', and then the next one, and so on. So it actually kinetically also has that order. So I think this is, again, evidence that the kinetic pathway is reflected in these equilibrium chemistry experiments that we're doing on titration. And there was something else I was going to say as well. Oh yeah, so it turns out also for the crystallographers have kind of known this a bit, who work on bacterial protein complexes, because when you try to express proteins, it turns out that it just works better if you maintain them in the native order. And I think that could be because of the assembly pathway. Yeah, Christian. Yeah?
So this evidence it seems that it goes against the fact that the assembly itself, the information for the other assemblies within the structure itself, if you need to express it in a specific order, it's because you need to bring something else to the assembly, right? So is it?
I mean.
So if the structure itself is.
Yeah.
All the information for the proper assembly, you wouldn't need to put the ingredients in the
system. No, I mean, I think it's basically kinetics,
yeah.
Right? This is the question of, you know, if an efficiency for the bacterium. I mean, in eukaryotes you don't have that, and in eukaryotes we have very little evidence for. You know, there's very little evidence out there that basically the mRNAs of the different subunits of the complex are somehow co-localized. But in bacteria, where there's, you know, lots of selection, Michael, you know, large population sizes and so on, this kinetic effect can make a difference, I guess. Yeah, but then you have to engineer the linkers so that they can geometrically kind of assemble and so on. Yeah, I mean. Oh, I see. You mean sort of kinetically for synthesis of the same.
Are they made by separate ribosomes? Or is it one ribosome that goes through?
I mean it's. You know, that depends on the mRNA to ribosome kind of concentration, right? But I don't think there's going to be just one that goes through and then another one. It's going to be lots at the same time. And then But then also the one that comes off may also go to the next, I guess, just because of spatial proximity. But I guess it depends on translation efficiency of the mRNA. And they can be actually different between different genes. Okay, so the answer to this is that yes, you know, there is, we have some predictive power to that we can use to say what the major intermediates are in assembly, and these pathways are significantly conserved in evolution for both homomers, and that was the work that I showed earlier, and also for heteromers, and this is work we published a few years ago, again in collaboration with Carol Robinson's group at Oxford. And so the bottom line here is that that buried surface area and the hierarchy of interfaces determines what are the major intermediates in assembly. And this is true for both homomers and heteromers. And now one thing that sort of people who are into protein structure may appreciate is that proteins aren't sort of completely rigid, static entities. They're kind of these flexible things that are dancing all the time and moving. And what's important in these assembly pathways is the hierarchy of interface sizes, but also sort of different levels of flexibility of the subunits plays an important role, and then that has knock-on effects on entropy. And so what we looked at with Joe recently was basically different extents of flexibility in different types of protein complexes. And intuitively, I think you can see that for more symmetric complexes, the subunits tend to be more rigid, like this dimer and this tetramer. And for more asymmetric complexes, like the cyclic complexes and completely asymmetric complexes, of which there are a small number, the subunits tend to be more flexible. And then these entropic considerations come into the assembly pathways. But that's a sort of detail. I mean, in general, this interface size principle is a driving force in evolution, or in terms of constraints on evolution. And so I just want to say thanks again to Emmanuel, who's of course now at the Weizmann Institute with his own group for the last 3 years. Joe Marsh, who's now got his own group in Edinburgh. Carol Robinson, who's a fantastic macromolecular mass spectrometrist and actually inventor of this non-covalent mass spectrometry in Oxford. And Sebastian Arnert, who's a long-term collaborator in the physics department for sort of graph theoretical algorithms. And I'll come on to his work at the end. Yeah. That's a measure that we developed a few years ago that was published in Structure by Joe Marsh and me, and I'm happy to discuss it later at 11 or whatever. So I'm not going to take the time for that now, just to get through. So it's based on buried surface area. It was one of the references I sent you yesterday. So the mutational mechanisms to get to to traverse the space basically from one quaternary structure to the next is something that's I guess we had to kind of tackle since we're doing these global studies. And the question that we're asking here is to get to from a monomer to a dimer or from a dimer to a tetramer, what are the precise individual mutations that take place? And as I said, intuitively you might think, oh, well, we need to make a sticky surface, we need to introduce some mutations in the interface. Let's just pop in some hydrophobic mutations at the right place for geometric complementarity. But let's look at this in more detail and actually study the homologs in PDB and ask whether this thing that I'm calling the direct model is what actually takes place. And with a direct model, you've got a mutation, this star basically, that's directly in the interface, and that disrupts or can make an interface. So you could go in either direction here. But what could also happen is that you have distant mutations, which we call allosteric mutations, where the effect is actually to distort either the individual monomeric subunit or the angle between the subunits, and then make this quaternary structure actually not possible. And so just to make that clear here, if we have a mutation that's within the subunits, one mutation that's within the monomer in this tetramer that for instance changes the angle between the two monomers, what can happen is that actually the tetrameric interface, the two tetrameric interfaces actually become sterically impossible. So they can't form anymore. And that's one mechanism for how these allosteric mutations could work. It's possible, of course, it's possible that you'd have this mutation and that somehow the protein would kind of accommodate it. There might be some tension within, it might be a bit less stable, there might be some tension within the quaternary structure, but it's somehow accommodated. But it could, what could also happen is that it just breaks apart. That's basically depends on the strength of the interface and the effect of the mutation. So we're basically asking, how often does this simple direct model occur? And that's what's classically been used in protein design. And how often does this more indirect geometric model occur where you have allosteric mutations? And what we did, what Tina Peretzer did was to collect all the homologs in PDB where there's high sequence identity, where we can actually track these mutations. And it turns out that there's not that many protein families where you have, say, 40% or more sequence identity in different quaternary structures. It's just, despite structural genomics and all the rest of it, the space just isn't that dense. And what we have in four families is evidence for the geometric model, where basically the interfaces, the residues in the interfaces, are pretty much 100% conserved. And so what we infer is that it must be mutations far away that are actually affecting the interface. And what we have in three of the protein families is you know, completely obvious mutations directly within the interfaces. And there are four families that basically have a hybrid of both things going on. And so it looks as if both of these things are pretty much equally important. Yeah.
Something doesn't become an interface until you are already in the tetramer. So when you say
okay,
conserved.
Yeah, but we know that this the patch can either be buried or solvent exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm calling that the interface patch.
It's changed. So
it's solvent exposed not because there are mutations there, because those amino acids are identical to the ones that are buried in the tetramer. It's solvent exposed because there are mutations somewhere else that are making the tetrameric interface impossible.
So my question is, why would they be conserved if the environment has changed so drastically?
Yeah, I mean, that's okay. So two answers to that. One is that there could be other constraints, and that's what I'll show in the next section, basically in the PRR family. So they could be RNA binding some other ligand in even in the tetramer if there's allosteric regulation. So these things are all in equilibrium, right? Just to make that absolutely clear. And there could be other reasons why that patch has to be conserved. And the other thing is just there hasn't been enough time, and you can only track that if you have very closely related crystal structures of closely related proteins. Yeah?
So does this model only work for
There's no directionality, so we don't know necessarily. So it's a double-headed arrow, basically. There's no phylogenetic tree here. We try to get to that in the next section, but again, you have to have a lot of data to infer that. Yeah.
So when you see that kind of thing, are those tetramers, do they have weaker interactions because that surface is not sticky?
That's a good question. We didn't quantify that, yeah. I mean, we should have. To be fair, there, you know, the data is so sparse that it's a completely reasonable question. But we didn't look at that in detail. Yeah. Okay. So basically, for the direct mutations, it's obvious how they work. For the indirect mutations, it's much less obvious. So let's look at a family in detail and try to figure out these mechanisms for these allosteric mutations. And so Tina Peretzer, who did this theoretical study that was published in PNAS, she kind of picked up the pipette very bravely and entered the wet lab. And this was a collaboration with Jane Clark's group, who's a biophysics group in the chemistry department in Cambridge. And what she did was to pick one of the families that were in that study, in her study on the evolution of the homomers, the different quaternary structures, and basically picked the PRR family, which is a bacterial attenuator family, so it's basically regulation of translation, transcription and translation. And this family binds RNA as a dimer, so this is coming back to your question about why is the interface conserved if it's a dimer, because it might be useless. But here, actually residues that are involved in the protein interface in a tetrameric form, when it's bound by an allosteric repressor, so this is a small molecule ligand, some of those residues are actually required for RNA binding when it's bound by a different allosteric ligand, so GMP instead of UMP, and when it binds to double-stranded RNA. So, and this is a case where you've very clearly got different states that are important for the function, different constraints from small molecule and nucleic acid binding and so on and so forth. But all of these things also are in dynamic equilibrium, obviously, so there's always a small population of the other species. Okay, so the reason that we chose this family was that there are two structures in PDB. One's a dimer, one's a tetramer. The tetramer is from a thermophile Bacillus catalyticus, and the dimer is from a mesophile Bacillus subtilis, and it's dimeric. And what we're trying to these are 70% sequence identical over 276 residues, and most of the changes are just on solvent-exposed surface that's probably completely doesn't have much, you know, impact. And so the question is, what are the distant mutations that are changing the unbound state of these so this is without small molecule or RNA binding, the unbound state of these proteins. And what Tina did was to use ancestral sequence reconstruction, taking sequences that weren't necessarily crystallized, but from other bacteria, and add them to a multiple alignment that contained these two homologs, and then back calculate using sort of maximum likelihood, like, you know, sequence reconstruction, what the most likely and inferred ancestral sequence would be at internal nodes in the tree on the pathway between these two species. And so what we hoped was that this would help us pinpoint the mutations that are switching the quaternary structure from dimer to tetramer. And so she basically did these calculations, ordered the DNA for the inferred ancestor, expressed it, purified the protein and so on, and then characterized it biophysically and by crystallography. And she did this for several variants and also for various sort of completely engineered kind of artificial proteins to get at the key residues out of the kind of candidates that we pinpointed, to get at the key residues that are responsible for the switch. And there were about 11 that we found in the end that were involved in the transition and the switching between the dimer and tetramer. And we dug down to these 11, as I said, through this ancestral sequence reconstruction and through protein engineering, and also tried to pinpoint the contribution of the different 11 residues. And so the nice take-home message here is that this switch from tetramer to dimer in this bacterial attenuator family, the reason that we have this switch naturally occurring is that you know, the mutations, the whole bunch of mutations that happen naturally between these two, induces a rotation between the individual monomeric subunits that makes the tetrameric interface geometrically incompatible in the Bacillus subtilis protein. So basically you have different angles between the monomeric subunits that make the tetramer then impossible in the Bacillus subtilis, whereas it's you have the nice helix-helix interaction here in Bacillus catalyticus, both at the top and at the bottom. The two red helices are in contact, whereas the two blue helices are shifted 5 angstroms apart and they're not in contact anymore. And this rotation is exactly corresponding to the rotation that you get in small molecule binding and allosteric regulation. And so when GMP is bound by this Bacillus subtilis protein, actually, so GMP is the repressor, sorry. So when GMP is bound, you have the tetramer, whereas when in the unbound state, basically the two helices again moved apart by about 5 angstroms, and you've got the dimeric state. So basically the conformational transition that happens here is exactly analogous to the one in evolution. And this is also what we engineered by introducing these 11 mutations artificially. We were able to switch from the ancestral tetramer to an engineered dimer with just 11 mutations, and we broke them down to groups of one group of 8 and one group of 3 mutations that was able to make the same switch. And we then kind of again dug down even further to try to understand exactly what's happening at the atomic level in terms of atomic contacts. And what we used here was sort of again graphs, but graphs at a more high level of resolution, where we're looking at the residue contacts in terms of atomic buried surface area. And what we showed was that the 3 mutations that are able to make the shift between dimer and tetramer, they basically introduce a set of residue contact rewiring. They're sort of hubs in this atomic contact network, and they introduce a bunch of rewiring that then changes the angle between the two subunits. So there's one subunit here shown in this representation, one subunit here, and if you have these three substitutions inside the protein, the two monomers sort of move apart, and that's what happens here. And so just to show this animation of the two crystal structures of the inferred ancestral tetramer that's in orange, and then the dimer is this one that you can see now. The closed state here is the tetramer with the helix contacts happening, and the open state is now the two dimers that are separate without the helix contacts happening. And so this is the conformational change that happens naturally in each of these proteins when under allosteric regulation. You're probably getting it to some extent. These conformations are being sampled in the free state, and then they're trapped by the small molecules, either one way or the other, by the two allosteric regulators. And this is the same conformational change, if you will, that happens in evolution. And so the question is, here this is shown as, you can kind of think of it as a hairpin opening and closing. This is the press office did that at EBI. It kind of baffled me what the person meant by hairpin, like the press officer, and I was like, oh, okay, you mean this that kind of hairpin, okay. So the question is, why is evolution choosing the same conformational pathway as allostery? And I think the reason is, you know, exactly what you sort of said intuitively, is why is that there are so many constraints on this protein that there's only a certain pathway that it's free to traverse, essentially, in evolution. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is that this protein has to be able to bind RNA, and as I said, those are the same residues, some of the same residues that are involved in the tetrameric interface, so they are constrained. It has to be able to bind GMP, which is the allosteric repressor, and UMP, which is the allosteric activator, and so it has to be able to maintain that conformational change as well, that allosteric change. It has to maintain the dimer interface, obviously, and so there's all these constraints on interactions. It has to maintain its own structure and stability and shape. And so so that what's left over for these bacteria to explore is basically just a certain pathway. I'm showing it as the cliff walk here. If you've been to a Gordon conference in Rhode Island, then there's in Newport, there's this beautiful cliff walk. And basically the protein has to kind of stay on a certain pathway in order to not fall down and lose its allosteric regulation, not fall down and lose its RNA binding and so on. And so the mutations that are allowed are ones that are basically going along the same shift that happens in its different functional states. So because they're just basically shifting towards one or the other of the different functional states. So that's basically the explanation. Stay on the paved path, maintain your function, and then you can accommodate the mutations and shift a bit from dimer to tetramer. And so the second part is here these mutational mechanisms. This is a lot of work here, a lot of biophysics, a lot of crystallography by Tina and also by others from Jane Clark's group and so on and so forth. So we're only able to look at this in this extent of detail in one protein family. But in this protein family, these indirect mutations that we call allosteric mutations are basically allowing, you know, the conformational change is one that's explored anyway during the natural function of the protein. And the mechanism of the allosteric mutations is to basically rewire residue-residue contacts. And the ones that are really switching the two states are ones that are at the hub of these atomic contact networks. And so just to summarize basically what I've said so far, I've showed you that protein complexes can change their state through mutations, through either the kind of intuitive, simple, direct mechanism, but also through indirect mutations that are acting essentially allosterically by changing geometry of within monomers or between monomers and having an impact on the higher order quaternary structure. And I also talked to you and showed you that assembly pathways of protein complexes are stereotypical. So we have evidence that they basically, it's far from a random, it's not a random search in the sense that there are major intermediates, and those intermediates are conserved in evolution, in both homomers and heteromers. And most importantly, I want to thank Tina again, Tina Paritza, who's one of these amazing wet-dry people who can span both the wet lab and protein bioinformatics, and has now gone on to do a postdoc at UCSF with Tanya Cortema. Jane Clark's group in chemistry, the biophysics service, Stephen McLaughlin at the LMB, where I was. Yasushi Kondo, a crystallographer at the LMB who helped with all of the protein crystallography. And then married Tina, who was interesting, sort of clever trick there to marry a crystallographer when you're doing a protein biophysics project. And Natalie Reuter from Bergen for the elastic network modeling, which I didn't talk a lot about, but it's basically showing you these in silico kind of simulations of conformational change. Okay, so Emmanuel. Yeah.
How often do you think that we have observed these mechanisms without the pre-existing pathway?
We don't. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, also that we'd have to. Basically, there were seven families in Tina's study that had these indirect mutations, and so we could dig into each of those. But I don't know whether you would have to have crystal structures in all the ligand bound and I mean, you have to, in order to be able to understand this like this, you know, we did crystallography with GMP, with UMP. We couldn't get the crystal with the RNA, but there's a homologous structure with RNA. I mean, so in order to understand it like that, you have to have all the ligand bound states. Yeah. Yeah.
But
that's always the case. I mean, you know, it's always in dynamic equilibrium and it's concentration dependent. So it's basically just the question is what's the major species and whether there's a conformational change when you go from one to the other. And you, what we could do is, okay, so we could do superpositions and see what the conformational change is. But then the question is that relevant for that species? We have the crystal structure of the homologs. You see what I mean? You can make estimates. I mean, it's a reasonable question. You could try to estimate from close homologs, if you see a conformational change, if you use elastic network modeling, would that happen within the same protein, the same kind of conformational change, and so on? Yeah. I mean, there was a paper from. No, so that reminds me. So there was a paper from. There's been a bit of work on this kind of question from Tanya Cortema. I think there was a PLOS computational biology paper where she looked at homologs and tried to infer how their space, like conformational space, was sampled, and then, you know, extrapolate that to the individual protein's conformational. So basically, the conformational changes that you predict for an individual protein, are they the ones that are sampled when you look across homologs? Are the vectors equivalent? So she had a PLOS computational biology paper, I think, on that. And then I think there was also a paper from Mike Sternberg on a similar thing, if I remember correctly. So that's the kind of question that you're asking. So you can kind of make estimates on that. And I think in general, the trend is for this to be true, you know, across. But to go into this level of detail, like for each family, you can't do it. Okay, so there's some time left, so that's absolutely fantastic. And what I'm really excited about, as always, is the work that we're doing right now, not the work that's already been done. And so I'm delighted to talk to you about a framework that we're trying to develop to predict basically what are the all possible topologies, in other words, connectivities of polypeptide subunits that are sampled in nature by different combinations of polypeptide chains. So don't worry about the details of this slide, but basically using all the data that we've collected experimentally with Carol Robinson's group, and then also just from the literature on assembly and disassembly, what we can extract, and this is sort of, you know, to some extent common sense, is that we can basically represent the intermediates in terms of this graphical representation that I've showed you all along, where we have these are two different polypeptide chains, the square and the circle, and then the different interfaces that are formed between them. And then what are the different transitions that take place in assembly?
In that previous slide, you got those just all in a mix happening.
Yeah.
Or those sweeping some salt or something.
I mean, that one, I think that was just, I assume that spectrum is one spectrum of one. And so you're measuring what happens is that you always have tiny amounts of each species, and then the relative proportions change as you traverse the salt concentrations. So if we again think about a polypeptide chain, a single monomeric polypeptide chain, then the different types of assembly transitions that can occur are a sort of heterologous asymmetric interface that's shown in blue. So I think this seems to have died a death, this pointer. Okay. Otherwise, I'll just try to resort to the... Oh, yeah, great. Okay. So there's the asymmetric interface that's shown here in blue. There's the symmetric interface, like in the homodimer, you know, that we've talked about, where you've got the internal symmetry that's shown in green. And then there's an interface with another protein that's completely asymmetric that's shown in red. And so if we add these subunits, then for the blue one, for instance, you'd form the simplest solution would be to form the trimer. It's just going around a circle. The dimer is the simplest one for this symmetric interface. And then adding a different subunit, just adding a completely separate protein is the simplest one for the heteromeric. And so these are really the three fundamental kinds of transitions that can occur. Yeah.
Is it really not possible to form a homomeric heterologous interface that only gives you a dimer because it's just too jammed to the angle such that you can't make a trimer or a dimer, but you don't end up having the interface hitting itself again?
So there are a small number of heterologous dimers, and I showed one a few slides back, but they're actually, we had a paper in Nature Communications that just came out that talks about that and all the different possible asymmetric complexes and how that can occur. So you can get asymmetry between the two with a ligand bound in one subunit and not in the other. So it's like a pseudosymmetry. You can get, but I would emphasize that they're rare, and what we showed was that there's, and I'll mention that later, is that there's tons of errors in PDB when in that kind of structure. Oh yeah, this one. I mentioned it here. This one. But it's rare, yeah. Here there's a ligand bound at the end. No, that's just showing that it's an asymmetric interface. What happens sometimes is there's a ligand bound or there's another protein bound at the interface, And then there's asymmetry because the ligand or the other protein is asymmetric, so it's like a 2-to-1. So there's different scenarios, but it's quite rare. So this asymmetric scenario that he just mentioned, where you've got two subunits that are interacting in an asymmetric interface, they can still be fit into this framework, but I'm not going to talk about them here, but we have considered them. Okay, so here you've got the triangle with these three blue interfaces. They're asymmetric. Here you've just got the two subunits with a green interface, and here there's the red asymmetric interface between the two subunits. So these are the major kind of transitions that take place. And if we that's sort of common sense. And if we quantify in amongst homomers the fraction of these different transitions, so we basically collect all the data and look for cases where they are either exactly the same polypeptide chain, and then there's a change, like a different polypeptide chain added in another complex, or very closely homologous complexes, and we look at the different kinds of transitions, then we can quantify in our mass spec data in the literature and from the crystal structures how many dimerization events, cyclization events, and sort of fractional transitions there are where you're adding another subunit, and this is the sort of distribution. And for heteromers, basically you've got dimerization, cyclization. Well, so fractional self-assembly basically collects. It's like a pot for all of those funny cases, where you've got that basically don't fit this model. And then you've got heteromeric subunit addition and non-stoichiometric transitions. So like 2-to-1 stoichiometries and so on in heteromers, which are also pretty rare. And so if we base if we take these three kinds of transitions, and we then basically enumerate all possible topologies, just using the graphical representation and sort of graph theory, then what we can do is to make these little topology diagrams for all different numbers of subunits, so different multiplications, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever different types of polypeptide chains. And so basically what we're doing is just imagining that we're adding interfaces either to one subunit or to both subunits at the same time. You know, you'd get this or this topology then, depending on whether it's this one or this one. And similarly here. And then basically in just doing like a brute force experiment, a brute force enumeration of all the possible topologies. And when we do that calculation, it's reasonably compute intensive, but it can be done, is that we can then organize the complexes into what we call a periodic table of protein complexes. And so what we have across the top is all the different topologies for one single subunit repeated. So this is all the homomers. Next row is basically all the possible topologies for two different subunits. Next one is three different types of subunits, so alpha, beta, gamma, and so on. Alpha, beta, gamma, and so on as you go down. And as you go across, you're basically doing different numbers of repeats of that basic unit, either one protein or two different ones, alpha, beta, repeated twice, three times, four times, five times, and so on. And then what you have, you can subdivide this into the different crystal symmetries. But then on top of that, our topology kind of representation gives you more information, because even for the same point group symmetry, you can get different kinds of connectivities between the subunits. And that's what these graphs are showing. So say for D3, you could have these three connectivities for two different chains. And yeah.
No question.
Yeah.
First of all, out of this possible none of them are really possible because they may be statically forbidden because of other parts of the protein block.
Yep.
And second of all, each of them is characterized not only by the graph, but each graph should be decorated with a number which is entropy. How much freezing.
No, sure. I mean, we could go down to the atomic level and so on, but this is The point of this level of representation of protein complexes is precisely to get away from that level of detail, take a step back, and to basically say, okay, what's theoretically possible? And then the question is, as you said, you can then ask basically which of these are more abundant, which of these are more commonly sampled, and which ones of them less. I think the steric thing is, I'm not sure it's absolutely relevant here, because you have to for each chain you could have a completely different shape. You could have small or large and so on. So the way we've tried to get at that is to predict basically that the power of a periodic table, in chemistry, the periodic table of the elements, is that it makes a prediction about what's present, what's possible in nature. And that's what we're trying to get at here, because here we've basically got three topologies out of five that are, so I'm showing actually three, but there are five here that are possible for two different subunits in with a D3 symmetry, with a dihedral symmetry. So the question is, are those two other ones, are they not present, for some reason, like steric hindrance or stability or whatever, or have they simply not been sampled yet by the crystallographers? They just haven't been solved yet. And so that's the power, one of the things that this periodic table can get at is predicting frequencies of different topologies. And so I'll come to that in a minute. The other thing that we can do is to say, okay, what's the, using these topologies, and I'm using this word topology to mean this graph, this connectivity pattern of subunits, that basically boils down the interfaces to the key interfaces that are in these major assembly steps. So there's not every single tiny interface is shown here, it's just the key interfaces that would be required to make each of the assembly transitions for a complex. And what you can see here is the rate of discovery of new topologies over time. And what's really interesting is that obviously initially there were very few complexes that had large numbers of unique different types of subunits, but that's increasing more recently. And the other thing is that's increasing is there's no saturation, basically. We're sort of finding more and more of these topologies as we crystallize larger and larger species. There are about 4 to 5 new topologies per year over the last 20 years or so, and there are about 120 in total that have been discovered now. And I think the electron microscopy revolution that's going on now will be really interesting for this, to see how this evolves in the future. And so what I mentioned was that for each cell in this matrix, we can say which topology has actually been observed in the crystallography data and which one hasn't. And I'll skip that, because that's just a comment on the fact that you can also use this for digging out quaternary structure errors. But basically the more important question is that we can ask which of these quaternary structures hasn't been observed yet, but we predict that it should be there, out there in nature, right? And these cells in the matrix are empty, and so what we predict is that these should be, populated. It's the blue was the symmetric, like interface, like in a dimer, and the blue one was the green one was the asymmetric. The red one was the one between two different subunits. It's like hemoglobin. It's a dimer that's symmetric. That dimer dimerizes to form another symmetric interface. So it's like if I take these two, and now my fingers are another two. This is a symmetric interface. There's one. Yeah.
Why did you stop at eight?
It's just
is there any I'm very interested in number 9. No, because of the symmetry of the structures that you're interested in.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
We know that there are some structures that may or may not assemble into 9 full symmetrical complex cradle symmetry.
No, you can extrapolate this to 9 in exactly the same way. The one thing that I'll say about the centrosome is that you know, it's interesting because it's this closed symmetry of the nine spokes, but then it's it goes into this open symmetry.
Yeah,
and so no, it's super interesting, yeah, and I mean, you can also extrapolate this to open symmetries, it's just that then, yeah, you, I mean, we haven't gone in that direction, but, yeah, now you, and the nine more in the plane, I mean, that's definitely, yeah, it just didn't fit on the thing, but we have the full periodic table online. Okay, so, just to say that, you know, looking back in the literature, we're not the first people who've done kind of brute force enumeration to predict frequencies of particular topologies, which is what I'm going to do next. So there's, for transcriptional network motifs, I mean, you're probably aware of Uri Alon's work where he's predicted sort of overrepresented motifs, like feed-forward loops and so on, being overrepresented in transcriptional regtu networks in E. coli, and the same is true in yeast. And then there's this nice paper from Chow where they sort of did a brute force analysis of all possible metabolic network motifs and then showed which ones are actually overrepresented in nature. And so what we want to do is the same thing for protein complexes. And the way we, I'm not going to go into how we did the frequency prediction, but basically we can predict based on the top row of, taking the frequencies from the top row of the monomers, we can do a sampling to the lower rows. And the other thing that we do is basically, so we take a complex that has a certain number of different types of interfaces, like blue, red, and green, or something like that, and then we basically say, okay, what would be the frequency if we have these three assembly steps, and we have a certain multiplication frequency of that module, how frequently do we predict that topology to be present in nature? And if we use this kind of heuristic, then what we get is a ranking of what we predict to be the topmost frequent topologies that have not been observed yet, and so you can see them here, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So the top one is basically two different types of polypeptide chains repeated 4 times in this sort of cubic symmetry that looks like a cube, and that basically hadn't been observed in the data set that we looked at. And then we took a data set 1 year later or 2 years later or something that included EM data, so low resolution EM data. And what we found then was that 6 out of the top, yeah, as you can see, the six predictions here out of the top 20, the ones that have these dashed lines around them were actually observed in this expanded data set that where we sucked in basically very fresh data and electron microscopy data, not just the crystallography data. And so we think this sort of validates our, for one thing, basically our enumeration of all possible topologies, and secondly, that we can use this to predict also frequencies of topologies. Yeah?
Sorry for being stubborn.
No.
So how we can do frequency prediction without accounting for entropy of each of these topologies. How many ways are there to assume?
Yeah, that we are taking exactly the number of ways into account. So basically, if you have, I mean, I can discuss it with you in detail later, but if you have these different assembly steps, so if you have, and it's exactly, the interesting thing is that it's exactly the number of ways that you can get to a point that's predictive of its abundance. So I don't have slides kind of to explain this, but if you take, let's say this cube, then how can I, I think this was the one that was frequent. How can I get here? I can get here by basically forming the dimer and then, going here, let's say, and then jumping there. So there's a certain number of transitions that you can do. No, this doesn't. I mean, this doesn't address, you know, atomic level of detail. So I've done a lot of work on that. But, yeah.
I guess I would be interested in, I guess, a different kind of entropy. It's a word I barely understand, but I mean, I would be interested in the underlying population genetics, because where you move depends on the rate of origin and loss of different interfaces. So I guess, right, that would ultimately dictate where you end up on this big spectrum. And then,
yeah, I mean, but there, yeah, so.
Any losses, then you would just end up going.
Ah, okay, I see what you mean. So whether you have like an indirect way of getting to a point where you've got a gain and a loss.
Kind of overall distribution of states, depending on how hard it is to gain, lose interfaces with any, you know, without a heterologous partner. We can talk about more later.
Yeah. If you take loss into account, like, it becomes much more complex. So actually, for this estimate, we were starting from kind of the simplest case, and then saying, okay, how can I get to each topology? You know, I have gain, bump, and I end up there, or I can go down this pathway. Like, I can go. Well, you'd have to go down first here, but you know, there are many different transitions that are plausible to get to one, especially for the larger ones, to get to one topology. And basically, especially the relative abundance within one cell of the matrix seems to correlate with that. But if you take loss into account, then you add like many different possibilities. Yeah.
So this is probably rare, but how do you cope with situations like, let's say, Crowell versus Eternosome, where what is exactly highly homologous, very similar, in one organism going to seven folds and rate of symmetry,
yeah, I mean that. I think these shifts are rare, right? I mean. And we don't take them into account actually also in this empirical simulation. So yes, they occur. Like that you go from here to here and you open the angle of the interface, and as you know, yeah, that's a beautiful example. But it's just a minority of protein interface evolution, I would say. And when we do this empirical simulation, we're not taking that into account. Yeah. I think it's too early to tell, but that's going to take off now, clearly, yeah. And that will be super interesting for us to kind of compare. It's a great question, yeah. Emmanuel? We're using the bar plot. So basically, there are two different, sort of roughly two different principles that were used. The principle that we use in the bar plot, yeah, okay. And we, so actually, yeah, so we use these frequencies, but we also use the starting kind of information about the frequencies of these topologies across the top here, where we have the most data, and it goes all the way from left to right, even to 9s, A, and so on. And then we basically use that to inform the lower rows. Yeah, we do, yeah, and the correlation coefficient is really high, yeah.
And so do you see some topologies that are unexpectedly frequent?
Ah, okay.
And so
yeah. So he's asking basically whether there are some topologies that are like unexpectedly frequent in the table. Yeah, I mean, there probably are, but there's a scatter, and basically, so we didn't look at that in detail. It's a good question, Emmanuel. Yeah, it's a good question. So one thing that I skipped, one thing that I skipped is that we can use this to root out PDB errors. Yeah, so Emmanuel, this is important for Pixie. So for people who are interested in quaternary structure errors and basically curating quaternary structures, what we find is that using the topologies and the ones that we expect that are symmetric and kind of conform to the sort of assembly kind of perfect shapes have the sort of 10% error rate that's the PDB average more or less. But then if you go to cases like this where you've got, you were saying, I think the asymmetric dimer, this is green, and then there's asymmetric interfaces here, so this looks completely weird. Then here, if we dig down, the error rate jumps to 60%.
What kind of error are you talking about? And how do you know there wasn't error?
Because there, the biophysical data from the literature says, this might be a dimer, and the crystal structure that's in PDB, the biological unit that's in PDB, says this is this weird tetramer. So that's how we basically go through it, goes one by one, by painstaking kind of curation.
So does that mean the crystal structure was different from the functional structure?
Yeah, itself? Yeah,
but
precisely.
So the crystal was right in itself, it just wasn't the same as the...
Yeah. Yeah. But it's an artifact of the crystallization. Yeah. No, it's not fraud or anything like that. Although we did find one that was actually so like outrageously. So Joe found one that seemed like completely implausible, and that was then turned out to be like a fraudulent crystallography paper. But there's no error in the solution of the structure or anything like that. It's just an artifact of the, and same here. So basically, for the heteromers, the same is true. So if you have the normal kind of heteromer, bijective means a one-to-one stoichiometry, the expected kinds of symmetrical interfaces, you have a 10% error rate. Here, with a two-to-one stoichiometry, this is already kind of rings some bells. There's something very strange going on here. It's not completely impossible. But then you've got a 20% error rate. And here, again, with these very strange asymmetric interfaces, 50% error rate. So, but these are rare. I mean, this is 2% of the structures, this is 6%, this is 7%, and so on. So this isn't like the whole database or something like that. Okay, so to kind of wrap this up, what we're doing here is using principles of assembly to predict topologies and put them in this periodic table framework of numbers of different subunits and repeats of subunits. And what I told you was that there are 120 of these topologies that have been observed so far by crystallography, and there's been about 4 new per year over the past sort of 20 years or so. We can use this framework to predict the top new topologies, and as I just mentioned, we can also use it to identify quaternary structure errors. So there's a direct kind of utility to this. And the two people who spearhead this together in a really nice collaborative way are Sebastian Arnert, who's in the physics department, the Cavendish, with whom I've collaborated for many years. I have a partial appointment in the physics department. And then Joe Marsh, who I said was an HFSP postdoc in my group and has now gone to Edinburgh. And we also had a continued to collaborate with Carol Robinson and Helena Hernandez in Oxford. So just to summarize the whole talk again, because I'm sure everybody's kind of worn out now, but I've gone on for an hour and a half, so I've given you good value for money, I think, here. So I talked about the constraints that assembly pathways place on complexes, and that we show that there are these stereotypical pathways, and using homology and gene fusion fission statistics, they do impose constraints in evolution. And we've dug down to identify different mutational mechanisms that can change quaternary structures in proteins, direct and indirect mechanisms, and that we've shown with PRR how the mutations can kind of hitchhike, the switches can sort of hitchhike on existing allosteric pathways in a protein. And then finally, the periodic table of protein complexes with these 120 observed complexes and new topologies. And so thanks, and I'll take any remaining questions now or at the discussion at 11. So. Thank you.